Well, 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 welcome back to a new episode of Joyride. I am Jared Brandon Flandy, and
I am Adam Mendenhall.
And this is the podcast where we talk about all things transportation and adventure. And how are you doing on another very hot Oregon day, Adam?
I'm doing well, but trying to stay cool like everybody else.
Now, if you're from California, Arizona, or anything like this, you probably guys are like, what's the big deal? But when anything gets about 80 degrees here, that might as well you'd be sitting on the surface of the sun, essentially.
Well put.
Yeah, in fact, I'm sweating right here, and it's probably, what, 60 degrees, 65 degrees in here. Let me wipe my brow real quick here. So we have a fun casual chat today, and, well, Adam, I have a few hometowns, just kind of like you, mm-hmm. Okay? So I was born in the big town of Lebanon, Oregon. I haven't been there in decades since. my other hometown would be Staten, Oregon, a very small town just right there on the Santa Ana River. But really, my main hometown is McMinnville, Oregon. I think that McMinnville, Oregon, would be one of your hometowns as well, right?
It is, actually. I mean, it's where I entered the world at, actually, was McMinnville, Oregon.
So I was in the Walgreens.
Yep, born in what's now a Walgreens. For years and years before that, it was the McMinnville Hospital. So many people, including my own father, actually entered the world there as well.
Really?
In years past, yeah. And we were delivered by the same doctor. That's what's even crazier. My sister, my dad, myself, and a number of my cousins. He retired back in, I think, 1984, before my brother was born. So, yeah, it's crazy. Some of those doctors, how long they held around, delivered generations of people.
Well, was he 105 by the time you guys were born? Or what?
No, but he was getting up there. He had the classic black rim bottle glasses.
Wow.
You know, I mean, from the era of when, you know, physicians were smoking inside the the waiting room and all that good stuff. And just a little spoiler for other podcasts that people haven't listened to. This same doctor, his nickname was Dr. DeLorean, because he was the doctor that I first had the privilege of seeing a DeLorean in real time.
Which is where we first met many years ago and didn't know. So
that's right. Yep.
Weird Twilight Zone series of events here. And you'd own that car eventually, too. That's hilarious.
It is, isn't it?
So being from McMinnville, I think, means, or Yamhill County, you know, which is the county it's in, means a lot of things in different ways because, you know, once upon a time, it still is to a certain degree, but very, you know, rural farm community type county, but more recent years we're known for wineries and mm-hmm. are kind of even been dubbed the new Napa in a lot of ways. In fact, there's been some big magazines that, I don't know if you've seen this, Adam, have named Yamhill County like one of the top 10 places in the world to visit right now.
Wow, I didn't realize it was that high up on the list.
Yeah, and a lot of it's due to the wine culture and the winery stuff, but other than, of course, the aviation museum stuff, which we talked a little bit about, what the other thing we're most famous for is the UFO Festival. Is that right?
That is true. That is true.
Now, there is some background to why we're famous for that, and it was a photograph that was taken in the 1950s. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah, it was the famous 1950 Trent sighting, in which two local citizens witnessed and photographed a UFO. And many at the time, and till this day, it's said to be some of the most credible images of UFOs to date. And that happened on the Trent farm here, just outside McMinnville.
Now, since this show is about transportation, I would count UFOs as a form of transportation, even though they're speculative, nonetheless.
So, exactly.
So that's why we're going to cover this. So this photo, as I think is, I mean, probably people listening to this have seen this and not realized it. So just look it up, the McMinnville UFO photo, if you're listening now or if you just have time later. And it's a very traditional image of what you think of as a flying saucer, is a better way of putting it.
It really is, yeah. Yep.
And it was, correct me if I'm wrong, Adam, it was probably, what, the late 90s that it was McMinivans decided, hey, maybe there should be McMinivans being a restaurant bar chain that's here as well.
It was, yeah, 1999, 2000, I think, was the first UFO Fest. So it's been going on for 23 years now, and McMinivans, you know, sparked that and got that event going, and it's had just a ever-growing following ever since.
And that's about the time my family moved here. And it was relatively small when it started, but there's always been the parade, you know, lots of people dressed up with their tinfoil hats or in their green skid, right? Mm-hmm. All sorts of cool stuff like that. But it's gotten a lot bigger over the 20-some years. In fact, I think it's now the second largest UFO festival behind the one in Roswell, right?
That is correct. It is. And a lot of that is due to the fact of the significance of the Trent sighting. And then again, over time, we've attracted a more rich audience, especially when it comes to speakers. They hold a number of speaking events throughout the festival. And we've had return speakers over the years, but typically every year it's a fairly new variety of speakers that come. And so that draws a lot of people in. On top of the activities which you already mentioned, the parade, we have a lot of vendors out there. So what's nice about it, it's really an all-inclusive experience for you know, people and their families. And then again, for those people that want to go attend something a little more focused, they can go to one of these speaking events.
So, you know, you're more dedicated to me than me, to be honest, because I usually always go for the parade and whatever the vendor food stuff is. But who are some of the speakers that were here in the latest one, for example?
Oh, so for the latest one, for example, one of the premier speakers was Travis Walton, who is one of the most significant alien abductees in the past. And so he was here to speak about his experience of being abducted by aliens, taken aboard their ship. Along with him, you have other people that have had different types of alien experiences, also paranormal experiences. So it's not always about aliens. There was an individual there that spoke in depth about Bigfoot and the origins of Bigfoot, alleged sightings, things like that. And there's also things that step into the supernatural, dealing with ghosts and things of that nature. I mean, alien is the staple point, you'd say, but there's actually a pretty good variety of people that come around to speak at these events.
So, what did Travis have to say in particular, though?
So, Travis Walton, for example, if people aren't familiar with him, he was abducted by a flying saucer in November of 1975 in the mountains of northeastern Arizona with six of his co-workers as witnesses that saw the entire event unfold before them. And so this one, till this day, is one of, if not the most significant cases of alien abductions that's ever taken place. And so Travis, you know, this happened many years ago. He has spoke countless times at this point about his experience and what happened and what he remembers. And there's also been a documentary that they did a few years back that he was promoting as well that covers it much more in depth. And they played that actually at the festival. You could attend that at one of the McMinivans cinema events that they hold within the hotel. And so what's great about the speaking events is, you know, he basically reiterates a lot of the stuff he's already talked about over the years. But at the same time, he takes Q&As from the audience. A lot of people can submit questions ahead of time, and they obviously screen those and then ask those questions to Travis. So it's always great to hear maybe a new question being asked and then see his response at that time.
So the documentary, I mean, this kind of does sound familiar. Was there a narrative film made about this too, or at least highly inspired by it? What was that called? Do you remember?
It was Fire in the Sky.
Fire in the Sky.
And
that's
Fire in the Sky was the original adaptation by Paramount Studios back in 1993, where they worked directly with Travis and took his story to the big screen. That being said, Fire in the Sky is a little embellished as far as what actually happened according to Travis, but it does cover a lot of the key points of his experience and his story. And where they really did a good job in that movie is portraying the actual initial abduction when he was with his co-workers up in the mountains logging as they were coming back down, seeing the flying saucer approaching it, and then seeing Travis taken away. And so that was a big film at the time. That being said, Travis did mention during the festival that at the speaking event that they are in the process of hopefully producing another film that's going to be a little bit more accurate to the story.
You know, and I think now you mentioned this, I have read some of this on this. So what is, like, at least according to him, what was accurate? So he was like a forestry worker, right?
Correct.
Along with his other coworkers. So they were up there doing work. And that's when they were heading home for the night or something. Is that what it was?
Yeah, they were heading home for the evening. So they were coming down off the mountain. They saw this, just this orange reddish glow that, I mean, at first they're like, oh my gosh, it's a forest fire because it's so big. And as they, you know, started driving closer, or they took basically one of the roads coming down the mountain that was adjacent, as close as you could get to the what appeared to be a fire. As they got closer, they discovered, well, this isn't a fire. This is actually a light. I mean, what is causing this? It just, you know, it's just this illuminescence of the forest, and it's just really intense. And there was no smoke. As they got closer, they discovered, well, where's the smoke at? And that was one of the things that led them to investigate a little bit closer. Now, as they approached the horizon through the tree line, and which unveiled, oh, this is actually a flying disc that's just sitting there hovering. At that moment is where everything went wrong, according to Travis. Out of his just sheer, you know, curiosity, he jumps out of the truck and goes closer. Everyone else stayed inside the truck.
I was going to say, why did he get abducted, not the other guys? So he got out to go check it out, essentially.
Yep, and he got as close as he could get to the device. The device, again, was just sitting there stationary, seemed to be observing. They weren't sure. Anyways, I mean, you can only imagine what that was like. And long story short, he was blasted with a blue light, which kicked him back. Again, his coworkers are all witnessing this in real time. That's what makes this such a, you know, important just event compared to other abduction cases where it's only one-sided. I mean, he had six witnesses there. Anyhow, kicks him aside. After that, another light comes out and picks him up. His coworkers absolutely freak out. Last-minute decision, they drive down the hill. They get about halfway down the hill. The crew leader at the time, who was driving the truck, decided, nope, we got to go back. They go back to check on Travis because they're like, we can't leave him, and he's gone, and so is the disc, is gone as well.
Whoa.
And so the other, what happened, transpired from that point, is they returned down to the local town, notify the authorities.
Snowflake or something like
that. Yeah, and Travis is gone for a period of 5 days. And at that point in Arizona in 1975, if there's not a body or something found, the people that were involved could be tried for murder or held accountable, basically no different than manslaughter. And so they were put through extensive polygraph tests, which all of them passed with flying colors more than once. There was multiple tests done. Long story short, they did an extensive search of the area. Nothing's found. 5 days later, Travis comes basically nearly near death, crippled, walking on a road there in the local town, finds a local phone booth, calls his buddy, come pick me up. And when they come find him, he was in dire shape. I mean, absolutely just exhausted, hadn't had water, food in 5 days. Anyways, they were able to get him medical care. Once he was, you know, healthy enough to answer questions, they had put him through a polygraph. Same thing. He passes with flying colors. And they brought in multiple polygraph technicians to administer the test there. And quite an event. Again, it's really worth researching or checking out the documentary that covers that in grave detail.
And so it wasn't just him, but it was the other guys he was working with that were polygraphed as well, right?
Correct. Yeah, extensively.
And they all passed?
They all passed.
Yeah. Wow.
And this is extensively documented, and they took it more than once.
So
more than once.
This is, did he have anything to say about his abduction in particular?
He did, and this is where it varies from the movie. The movie, basically, it gets a little embellished on the horror aspect of it all. And the movie, some of the final scenes is these flashback scenes where he actually remembers waking up on the craft and what happens. And not to spoil it for anybody, but it goes kind of more towards the horror aspect. And you know, goes off the rails there a little bit, just for that entertainment factor. What actually happened was a little different. He remembers out of 5 days, he remembers less than 3 hours is what he actually remembers. But he does remember being on the ship. He remembers being held down. He remembers having something put over his mouth, and then he passes out. But he did interact with beings, actually tried to attack one just to defend himself. He was in an open area where there was a flat table. He grabbed what looked like, you know, medical instruments, and it was a sharp device that would basically be the closest thing to a knife from what he can describe.
Scalpel,
defend himself. Anyways, he didn't actually harm any of the beans, but he did push one back. And these were, again, beans that your classic, you know, 3 foot high, large heads, black eyes, which is your, you know, typical alien gray is the easiest way to say it. But they were wearing clothes from what he describes. And again, this is all covered in grave detail in the actual documentary. So anyhow, the total time he experienced on that ship interacting with these beings was less than 3 hours out of the 5 days that he was actually away.
Did he have any memory or description of the beings themselves, or did he just not really get a good look at them?
No, he does. Yeah, he did. He got a very good look at them, very close.
And how did he describe them, though?
He described them as, it was, again, you know, you're 3 to 4 foot tall, large heads, black eyes. What's interesting, and they'll cover this in the documentary, is that's what his initial interaction, and that's what he initially observed. And after he had the reaction that he had, which is basically shock and fear, they left the room and he was left alone. And then shortly thereafter, what appeared to be a human in a spacesuit comes back out to interact with them, which was really puzzling. He's like, you know, okay, now this is a little more familiar form that I can interact with. Whether that was an image that was projected in his mind or it was a humanoid type being, unsure. But nonetheless, they cover that in the documentary.
And he doesn't remember the time between this and being walking to the phone booth. He just woke up somewhere. Is that what I'm gathering?
What happens is what he remembers is being blasted with light, waking up on the ship, passing out on the ship, and then he's waking up on a road as a bright light is taking off. They basically dumped him on a road knowing that, oh, this is a path somewhere, you know, and it was only a couple miles from town. And so, again, the local town, the area that he was originally taken from is where they dumped him back off. But they dumped him off in the middle of the road. And unlike the movie, he was actually dumped off with clothes. You know, he wasn't just dumped off.
I didn't bring that up because I know that was a bad taste. But honestly, I was curious if he was clothed or not.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Anyhow, but again, hadn't had water. So, I mean, this guy was dehydrated, hadn't had food. I mean, he was in what basically most people would be a near-death situation. Due to that, the circumstances. But, I mean, it had enough, enough aptitude and just energy to make his way. I mean, he started recognizing the area, make his way to the local town, found a phone booth, and called his friend.
Now, my question is that, you know, there's a Hollywood movie about this. There's a documentary made about this. Is like, well, how did his story get out? Like, how did he mention like how that kind of went to that progression of like?
Because he ended up as a it was a missing persons after his friends reported it to the authorities. He became a missing. It made national news back in 1975. Okay. National news.
So this is in the 70s.
Oh yeah, okay. Mid 1970s. The FBI came to investigate after that.
Oh wow.
Yeah, and so that was, and that's also that is portrayed in the 1993 film as well. And it was James Garner that plays the agent that comes out.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. It's been a while since I've seen it, but yeah, you're right. Yeah.
To investigate this further, and it's really interesting. And again, what makes it so significant is the amount of witnesses, the testing that went on, and this was a national thing because he was gone. These people were being held going, what did you do with your friend? They were trying to push him going, just tell us where you hid the body. Where'd you bury him at?
Thinking they
killed him because they go on this extensive search of the entire surrounding area where they were logging, where he was taken. And nothing to be found. And then here we are 5 days later, boom, there's Travis. So pretty wild stuff. And that's what's neat about the UFO Fest. You have opportunities to meet some of these people in the flesh. And I was fortunate enough to meet Travis in person and talk to him. And it's an amazing experience. And they've had other people, too, not just abductees. They've had, ex-government workers that allegedly have worked on, you know, recovered alien craft, back engineering purposes. Bob Lazar is a significant one that showed up here in 2019, UFO Fest, along with Commander David Fravor. He was the tic-tac-toe pilot on the USS Nimitz who witnessed, the tic-tac and actually pursued it with his jet.
May I stop you real quick? What is this incident? The tic-tac-toe? Did I hear that right?
Yeah, the tic-tac. Interesting. And that's okay. The 2004 incident where there was a USO, it was a submersible UFO, anyways, that was coming up out of the water. Anyways, initially there was some disturbances in the water, and this is off the off on the Pacific coast down between San Diego and, I mean, basically, I forget exactly where in the water, but South America. Anyways, the USS Nimitz was called to investigate a disturbance, these disturbances in the water. Anyways, they go to investigate, and long story short, not only they witness these what look like massive whirlpools, they witness a what appears to be a large, basically, if you can imagine what a Tic Tac looks like, a breath mint, but 40 feet long, come up out of the water.
So cylindrical and large, okay.
Yep. White Tic Tac comes out of the water and then takes off, and the jets pursue.
Once again, I think I've read something about this. When did this take place? Do you remember?
That was 2004.
Oh, 2004. Yep. So not that, and that 19 years ago.
Exactly. But, and that footage, the originally the classified gunner footage and the radar footage that was taken by the jets that pursued that has since been declassified. This information has been relayed on major networks like ABC News here as of a couple years ago. David Fravor has been on multiple programs, including ABC News and others, to talk about this, along with his co-pilot, his female co-commander. She was a lieutenant commander. I forget her name at the moment, but she has also come forward and interviewed. It's really interesting. That's another significant one. So that's the kind of stuff they've had at the UFO Fest that really, I mean, it's really neat stuff, because you get a mix of obscurity, but also major, I mean, highly reputable people, such as Commander David Fravor is one of them, that speak at these events on their experiences.
And have you been to any of these other speaking events other than the one that Travis Walton did?
Yes, I have. In fact, I would say 2019, Travis was incredible, because honestly, aside from the Barney and Betty Hill case in 1962, I think it was, early 1960s, that was another abduction case. Travis's is the most significant. And Barney and Betty Hill obviously are not physically with us anymore, so you can't talk to those people. But as far as living goes, abductees, Travis, in my opinion, is second to none, just because of how significant, how well documented his case was of the events that happened. But yes, I have been to others. 2019, we got Bob Lazar that actually came by to speak. And Bob Lazar is the man that blew the lid off Area 51, that put it on the map for everybody, including Element 115, that did not exist in 1989. But guess what's on the periodic table today? You get any periodic table of elements, Element 115 is now on there. And Bob was talking about that in 1989 when he spilled the guts on the reverse engineering program of recovered alien craft that he was involved in.
And what is the name of Element 115?
I forget.
It's all right.
Yeah, the actual technical name. It's a tongue twister.
But it was something that was apparently discovered when they were reverse engineering craft.
It's an element that does not naturally occur on our planet even in our solar system. But apparently it's a material that was recovered with previous crashed UFOs, and it's used as a fuel in a gravity. It's a reactor that produces gravity waves, essentially a gravity propulsion device. Which allegedly, again, I'll just use that loosely, is the propulsion system used on a majority of these crafts that bend space-time. It's, you know, the easiest way to put it to people, which is not going to be accurate, is imagine warp drive Star Trek, but real.
And apparently Bob Lazar worked at Area 51 during...
He did, 1988 to 1989. He was there for a period of months, but he worked at an area... So Area 51 is broken down. He worked in an area called S4, which is a sub area to Area 51 on the Papoose Lake bed. It's a series of hangars that was built in a facility that's built in the mountainside, completely separate from Area 51, but in the same complex, essentially. So to go there, you have to actually fly in the Area 51, take a bus that goes about 12 to 15 miles down the lake bed to a separate facility where allegedly they had 9 recovered non-human alien craft. He was privied to work on one of them, a very compartmentalized project, mind you. He was exclusively hired to work on and back engineer the propulsion system on one of these craft. And this is an extremely well-documented, the most well-documented event as far as George Knapp, who originally did the investigation on him to verify his existence. And what's interesting is they did the investigation because when Bob started spilling the guts, the government tried to start erasing him as a person, erasing his history, where he went to school, MIT.
Discrediting him.
And they found evidence of that, and they found out that he did indeed was gathering a check from the Department of Naval Intelligence, who essentially heads up these programs, and that's how he was getting paid. And other people have come forward. There's a lot of evidence to support Bob Lazar's claims of him actually working on one of these craft. On top of that, at the time, he was a good friend with John Lear, whose family is famous for the development of the Lear jet.
Yeah.
Bob knew the flight times and invited John Lear, along with some other fellow scientists, to observe these remotely outside of Area 51. And sure enough, Bob's flight times were correct, because what they witnessed at the time were UFOs exactly where they would be when he had said they would be, because he knew when they did the test flights. And that's how he got caught. He actually got caught with a group of people out there where Area 51 military police and personnel caught and retained people, especially himself. And long story short, it went downwards from there.
You know, I've followed this a bit, or, you know, read about this, studied a bit over the years, maybe not quite to the extent you have, but, you know, I'm personally of the belief, as vast as our universe is, and as vast as possibly the multiverse is, it's awfully arrogant to think that we're the only living, you know, intelligent entity in this realm, right?
Absolutely. I'm right there with you. To each their own. Obviously, it's an extremely controversial subject that challenges people's entire belief systems, religions, so forth, our way of life, our understanding of the universe. But I think it is, even at this point, to stare up at the night sky and just the amount of stars that reside within our own Milky Way galaxy, let alone the other known billions of galaxies. I mean, how could we think that we're all alone? So,
well, you can go back to the Roswell incident, which, you know, quote unquote, apparently happened, and all the things that, quote unquote, once again were made confidential or unconfidential. But I'm noticing more as of the recent period, and I mean like last 5-10 years, it seems like more of these things that have been declassified for a long time are now starting to become declassified. And I'm not saying I'm right on this, but I'm wondering if those who know, you know, them, they, so to speak, I'm wondering if them, they is starting to come to the point that they're thinking maybe society is getting ready to accept this notion.
Actually, that's a real hot topic right now, because there are a lot of people that absolutely back what you just mentioned and do believe that this is just a stage of disclosure, and they're slowly taking steps towards full disclosure, but they're doing it in real small little
baby steps.
Little baby steps, yeah. You know, they're handing it out to us, so.
Yeah, because, you know, I mean, I've read some stuff that's apparently, it's like there was reports made back in the 60s saying if you, like back during the Apollo program, it's like if you find out any extraterrestrial information, it'll tear society apart because it's just so mind-blowing.
Exactly.
Both just in its concept in terms of people's traditional religion and so forth, you know?
Well, just the essential foundations of society, right? That's been the biggest concern. It would just undermine that entirely, so.
But I'd like to think 50 plus years later, we're starting to become more, you know, collectively comfortable with this idea.
I think we are. I really do. And there's a lot of people that have very recently and currently are covering that very subject. Again, it's a very hot topic right now.
What exactly were they coming to see in Yamhill County before there was vineyards? I'm not entirely sure, though, to be honest with you.
Right. You know, maybe they were checking out, they're trying to find Mr. Raymer Schreiber. I don't know. It seems like, you know, the atomic factor is where these things all started showing up after World War II. So, just joking around, but nonetheless, you know.
It could be, exactly. If no one has seen that movie, by all means, check it out. It's The Half-Life of Genius, the physicist Raymer Schreiber on Amazon Prime, where I direct that, and Adam actually plays the young Raymer Schreiber.
I do. Yes, it's a worthwhile trip.
So please, I'm wondering, are you actually an alien, Adam? I don't know. They say Elon might be, so I don't know.
Yeah. The jury's still out on Elon. I can assure you, I'm 100% human. But Elon, boy, yeah, it's hard to say these days.
Well, before we close up here, Adam, do you have any last minute thoughts, comments? Before we're done here,
you know, I would just again encourage people that you know, are interested in the subject of UFOs or even just paranormal in general. Again, our podcast here most recently covered, you know, essentially UFOs, but again, the UFO Fest is so much more, especially any of the fun stuff. And whether you believe it or not, honestly, what's made it so successful is it's really an all-inclusive thing for kids, people, family, people of all ages. You can go there, have fun, partake in the more intense, you know, speaking events or not. Either way, you're going to have a good time. So I really encourage people to check it out that haven't.
Well, I think I was telling you when I met up with you there, I was talking to a police officer right before I met up with you that was directing traffic. And mind you, I was totally kind of in the same mindset, is that it was packed. I never saw it so busy this particular year as of 23.
It really was, wasn't it? Yeah. Especially the parade. It was impressive how many people.
And that police officer, he told me, he said, if it keeps being this way, we're going to have to think of something different, because we don't, the town doesn't have the capacity to handle this. And it's lots of people, just not, it's people coming from all over the world now that are coming to this thing.
That's the one Achilles heel to our nice little small area. McMinnville's not super small, but it's small enough. We just don't have enough hotels to, you know, house that many people. So,
well, we've tried building those, but they've been declining.
Yeah, exactly.
That might start changing here. We'll see. All right, everyone. I want to thank you once again for listening. By all means, check out our Patreon. We support any, or we appreciate any support you can give. And do check out any of the links we have in the description boxes below. We'll probably put some stuff regarding UFOs and the UFO Festival as well, if you do want to check that out. And me and Adam, of course, will be back for another story episode coming up. So I hope you look forward to that. So with that said, we're going to close. Does that sound good for you, Adam?
Sounds good to me.
All right. And we'll catch you guys next time. So signing out.